Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I am Yuyun Zhan, host of our monthly podcast, Zhonghua Mundus, that brings you recent updates about China's economy. As usual, I am with our senior fellow, Alicia Garcia-Herrero. Hi, Alicia. How are you?
Hello, Yuyun.
Good to see you again, Alicia. We're also glad to have with us today Jonathan Fulton, a non-resident senior fellow for Atlantic Council's Middle East programs and the Scowcroft Middle East Security Initiative. Nice to meet you, Jonathan, and welcome to The Sound of Economics.
Thanks, Yuyun. Nice to meet you, and you too, Alicia.
Thanks for joining us today. Since 28 February 2026, the U.S. and Israel have been at war with Iran, having launched strikes targeting military sites and assassinating Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei. Iran retaliated by effectively closing the Strait of Hormuz, a critical global energy choke point, and has been attacking commercial ships attempting to transit without its approval. The U.S. has maintained a naval blockade since April 13th. Negotiations are being mediated by Pakistan, with key issues including the Strait, Iran's nuclear program, sanctions, and a long-term peace agreement. This completely reshapes the China angle. China depends heavily on Gulf and Iranian oil, and the Hormuz closure directly threatens that supply chain. It also puts Beijing in an extraordinarily awkward position diplomatically. Alicia, China is the world's largest oil importer, and a huge share of that supply runs through the Strait of Hormuz. This crisis has stress-tested that dependency in real time. What do we learn about Beijing's actual vulnerability and its contingency options?
Thank you, Yuyun, for the question. Yes, when you look at kind of big figures, yeah, China is the largest importer of energy in the world, fossil fuels in particular. You know, the immediate thing you would say, okay, China is very dependent and, you know, this is going to be a huge shock. But, you know, if we look at that in detail, I would say every single Southeast Asian economy, even Japan or South Korea, are more dependent than China on the Strait of Hormuz and on the Gulf. Beyond that, i.e. diversification of energy resources or oil, fossil fuels in particular, that China has been pushing forward for a long time, to the point that even with Russia, they've been very careful of not becoming too dependent. Yeah, so you know, it's like really embedded in China's strategy. But beyond that, of course, you know, you still see the still very relevant share of coal in the energy basket, or renewable for that matter. So yes, China is hit. I mean, nobody can deny it, but not as much as you would just imagine by thinking, okay, this is the largest importer in the world. So China is more resilient than we think. That doesn't mean it's fully insulated.
It's true that indeed China had been quietly absorbing large volumes of discounted Iranian oil for years, and it's a lifetime for Tehran under sanctions. Alicia, do you think the conflict has effectively ended that arrangement? And if so, what does losing that supply and that leverage mean for Beijing?
Well, Jonathan is going to really give us so much information on this. You know, I've been reading his Substack, and I can tell you we have a great expert. So I'm not going to step on Jonathan's shoes because he can give more. But just the sense, you know, of where we stand. This is not only Iran. This is Venezuela. This is Russia. I mean, China has been in a position to import a lot of discounted oil from a lot of sources. Iran is part of that story, but it's not an Iran story. That's what I would like to highlight. Not only does China have like the infrastructure, these teapot refineries, this, you know, the whole ecosystem, but China also has the payment systems, the China cross-border international payment system, CIPS, as basically an amazing tool to do this. And therefore, in a way, it is kind of logical that China does it because the cost of doing it is much lower than for anybody else. Not everybody can do what China does in terms of importing discounted oil and kind of reducing to the bare minimum. I would not say to zero, though, the consequences of those actions. Yeah. So yes, this has been the case. And as I said, it's not the only place from which China is importing discounted oil.
Jonathan, I see that you're nodding. Do you want to add anything here?
No, I'm nodding because I think at least you got it right. China's taken advantage of a pretty unique set of circumstances since the Russian invasion of Ukraine, that it's been able to really reinforce its reserves. If I think this goes back to the US invasion of Iraq in 2003, where I think at that point China was quite vulnerable to energy shocks. And seeing, energy hitting or oil hitting $140 a barrel was a big problem for China. So this idea that, hey, Venezuela and Russia and Iran didn't have a lot of options globally for places they could sell their energy, and China, was able to take advantage of that situation. And we've seen really 4 years of just really replenishing their reserves and kind of reducing that dependency or vulnerability.
Great, thanks very much for that. Going back to the region, China was simultaneously deepening ties with Iran and also with Saudi Arabia, the UAE, so Iran's regional rivals. This crisis has put that balancing act under enormous strain. Is Beijing's friends with everyone approach still viable?
It depends what you think the end goal is of this approach. If you think that China wants to be a major extra-regional power and play some kind of diplomatic, political, or security role, then this would be, obviously a big strain on their position. If you think China comes to the region because of the energy and the contracting and the trade for the economic opportunities, then this approach is pretty durable. I think what we've seen, there was a period I kind of refer to it as the peak China Middle East hype, when Xi Jinping went to Riyadh in December 2022. And shortly after that, Iran's president went to Beijing, and there was the announcement that BRICS was expanding to the region, and the SCO, Shanghai Cooperation Organization, was admitting Iran as a full member, and all of these Arab countries joining as dialogue partners. And then there was the stunning announcement of the Saudi-Iran rapprochement that was, announced in Beijing. All of these things together made it look like China was going to be a really major power, that had been collecting this capital through its economic position over several years, and it was now ready to turn that economic capital into political capital. And then October 7th happened that year, 2023, the Hamas attack on Israel. And you could see, China's position in the region again reverted to what it had been really forever, an economics first, trade, contracting, energy. And I think a lot of actors in the region might have been confused to think we see China as such an important partner, and they should be doing more politically. They should be helping us with these security problems. China looks at the Middle East, I think, in economic terms. In strategic terms, it's far more preoccupied with its own periphery, the South China Sea, East Asia, the whatever 13 or 14 countries it shares borders with. The Middle East is not very high on its list of priorities in terms of foreign policy. So this friends to everybody, they can continue doing this. They can sell dual purpose things to Iran that might be used as rocket fuel, or might be used as drone components that might be launched towards the Gulf countries. And they can continue to get contracts for infrastructure and renewable energy projects in the GCC. That can keep going indefinitely, because if you just see China as an economic partner, then its political positions don't really get challenged in a very meaningful way.
So with that strategic position in mind, has China been a decisive actor in this conflict or more of a bystander?
I don't know if I'd say it's either a bystander. I certainly wouldn't say it's decisive. Really, there's only two decisive actors, Iran and the US, in this conflict. And the Israelis have some room to influence the Americans, and maybe the Gulf GCC countries might as well. But what we've seen, I mean, this war is a story about those two countries and everybody else. Like Alicia said, there's a wide range of countries that are affected, probably much more dramatically than China. India is really hurt by this, and the Philippines and all these Asian economies that import so much and have huge expatriate populations in the region. So China's played a role. It's facilitated some diplomatic maneuvering, and it's worked with Pakistan, and but at the same time, it can't move the needle on this. It can't It has no leverage with the Iranians to get them to change their behavior. It has no way to get the US to change its behavior. What China's doing is what you would expect of a second or third tier extra-regional power. It can convene, it can, try to set agendas, but it's not going to really play a decisive role.
Alicia, what do you think China's role has been in this conflict?
I would say that, whoever deals with China always feels that China has a decisive role because that's the way we see the world. I see the world that way, but I realize that listening to Jonathan, maybe I'm a little bit biased because I see China everywhere. Like I see China in behind Pakistan in these negotiations, but I'm not sure whether, I mean, put it this way. I sense that China is behind. That doesn't mean that Pakistan does everything China wants. It's a different story. I mean, China is probably trying to, on the one hand, get to a favorable deal. This is weakening the US, and the US is China's strategic competitor. It's obvious, yeah? So I can see that China has an interest in steering these negotiations. But at the same time, China cannot, because whatever happens here will hurt the world. And by hurting the world, it will hurt China, because China needs those exports to the rest of the world. Yeah, I mean, so China has to be very careful in what it wants. And therefore, I imagine that China is also very careful in pushing one way or the other, because it can kind of break that balance. So for sure, China is not a bystander. China is very well informed. I'm sure China is, on top of every negotiation, even if not at the table. But I also think that China will be very careful in pushing in one direction because it might break. It is just a very, very difficult situation to push, especially if you're not at the table, because you can maybe hurt yourself by doing that. And I think China is humble about the region. I think that's something I wanted to ask Jonathan, by the way. This is a difficult region, There's been instances when we had this kind of China brokered rapprochement between Saudi and Iran. But nobody even remembers that. You see what I mean? In other words, this is a region where you have to be humble about. I mean, like, it is just not easy to move the needle. And I think China has learned that the hard way. And I do agree with Jonathan that maybe that influence, that was the peak in time. Yeah. We had this big deal with Iran 2021, then, Iran getting into the BRICS, this broker deal, everybody's friends. Look where we are now. Yeah. So I'm sure that, if I were running MOFA, or running at least part of that MOFA in China on the Middle East, I would be thinking, gosh, this is complicated. Yeah, so that is why I think, I mean, my sense is they're not bystanders by no means, but they're also not sitting with the wheel, knowing exactly how to drive the conversation, because it is just too difficult for anybody. And the US proves how difficult this is. Yeah, it's very clear. And before that, the Europeans. So, it's not that you are going to come and figure out how to solve the problems in the Middle East all of a sudden. That's my take on this.
Jonathan, in your previous answer, you talked about the highlight of China-Iran relations in 2021. Indeed, they signed a sweeping 25-year cooperation agreement that year, covering energy, infrastructure, and reportedly also security. Before the war, how much of it had actually materialized, and what does the conflict do to whatever that was left of it?
This is an easy one to answer because before the war, almost none of it materialized. It's just a giant hype machine, this partnership agreement. Xi Jinping went to Tehran in January 2016. He was the first head of state to visit Iran after the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the nuclear deal, was signed. This multilateral deal that was negotiated in 2015. So it's important that she was the first to go, because China wasn't really acknowledged. It was one of the P5 actors, but it wasn't really seen as playing a very big diplomatic role in getting Iran to that deal. There's a really great China scholar, John Garver, who's retired from, I believe, it's Georgia Institute of Technology. But he wrote a chapter about China's role behind the scenes, and he documented something like 16 visits from very high-ranking officials on both sides in the 13 or so months before the JCPOA was signed. And what he documents is a lot of incentives that China provided Iran. You don't want to sign the JCPOA. You don't want to, surrender part of your sovereignty, your nuclear sovereignty, to get this deal. But if you do, we've got this Belt and Road Initiative, or I guess at the time, the One Belt, One Road. We'll be able to help you modernize your ports and infrastructure. We'll invest. We're going to help you, bring your energy infrastructure up to speed. There were a lot of incentives provided to the Iranians by Beijing to get them to the deal. And then they signed the deal, and Xi Jinping arrived very shortly afterwards. So it's not a coincidence. This was a huge moment in China-Iran diplomacy. And that's when they announced the signing of this comprehensive strategic partnership agreement. And they said, within a decade, the economic relationship is going to increase to $600 billion. We're going to do all of this infrastructure with you. We're going to help you modernize your, everything. Basically, all the narratives we have about the BRI, were going to come to fruition in Iran, which is seen as this big pivot state, right? Access to the Gulf, overland transit routes to China. The reality is, a few months later, Donald Trump was elected president. And immediately, China stopped talking about Iran in any kind of strategic way. And you didn't see, when Donald Trump ran for president, he didn't talk about foreign policy very much, but the two things he frequently talked about was the Iran deal that Obama signed was the worst deal in history, and that China is constantly taking advantage of American strategic stupidity. So, I think what Beijing looked at this moment and thought, okay, we're doing about $600 billion worth of trade with the US every year. We're doing about $18 billion worth of trade with Iran. Iran is isolated in its own region. It doesn't have very many useful friends. Zai Jian, Iran, like you could see China basically drop Iran very quickly. So in 21, after Trump had pulled out of the JCPOA unilaterally, which was a big slap in the face for a lot of, actors who were involved in the negotiations, Trump implemented this maximum pressure round of sanctions against Iran with the goal of decimating the regime's economy and knocking them out of power. And China started to support Iran a little more fulsomely. And I think it wasn't out of any kindheartedness. I think it's because China's Gulf interests were at stake. Maximum pressure meant that it had become a security liability. Iran started to lash out. It attacked Saudi Aramco. It attacked tankers in the port of Fujairah here in the UAE. It was attacking sites in Iraq. And it looked like things were getting pretty heated in the region as a result of Trump's maximum pressure campaign against Iran. And China reached out to the Iranians and said, "Look, you're not alone. We'll help you out. Just stop blowing everything up." So that's when they, Wang Yi went to Iran and they formalized this 25-year agreement. It's pretty important to note that every Chinese official at the time said there's nothing quantitative in this partnership agreement. Any numbers you heard were leaked by the Iranians. There was always this $400 billion investment pledge that Iran couldn't even absorb if they wanted to. And it completely flew in the face of all of China's much more modest approach to international investment after 2017, which was the high point of BRI, overseas investment. So the Iranians were using this kind of as a way to say, "Look, we've got China," telling their domestic audience, "Look, we've got this great power. They're promising all this stuff to us." But the reality is, China had done almost nothing in terms of investment. The trade had diminished tremendously. They were still doing this kind of taking advantage of Iranians' vulnerability to buy cheap, discounted oil. But what you saw in reality was hundreds of, like so much money being invested into the UAE, so much money being invested into Saudi, and almost nothing into Iran. And the Iranians complained bitterly. And every meeting the Iranians had with Chinese officials would always have the same talking points. It's time to move beyond the signing stage and move into the implementation stage where we can actually see this partnership do something. And they've been saying this now since 2021. And, I think with the Hamas attack in 23, when the region became much more volatile and China became much less interested in doing big projects for the Iranians, you could see it's been about almost 3 years now of Iran really getting very little from the Chinese. So that partnership agreement, I mean, I understand why the Americans bring it up a lot because it's a sexy story and it makes it seem like there's some some axis of revisionist actors that are trying to overturn global order. But the reality is, there's very little love lost between them. China doesn't trust Iran. Iran doesn't trust China. And the partnership hasn't really materialized anything beyond rhetoric at this point.
Yeah, thanks for putting all that context. That's quite important for the listeners to take away. You talked about Saudi, indeed, that China brokered the Saudi-Iran normalization deal in 2023, and that was with great fanfare. That now looks like, a completely different era. What does this crisis do to China's credibility and ambition as a regional diplomatic actor?
Not to be, a shameless self-promoter, but I was asked to write a report for the UK Ministry of Defence last year. And the idea was a lot of people had looked at, like, what I referred to this kind of peak China Middle East hype. This sense in a lot of Western capitals that China was increasingly becoming a major extra-regional actor in the Middle East. And a lot of governments were saying, we got to understand this better. So they asked me to write this report. What is it that we're seeing? How does the Middle East interpret China's deeper diplomatic engagement? So I talked with people in Egypt and in Israel and in Qatar and in Saudi and Iran and the UAE, and basically everybody came back to me with the same answer. We see China as a very transactional actor in the region. We don't see it as a very useful diplomatic partner. It doesn't understand us. It's not very interested in us. It likes doing business here. But, to Alicia's earlier point, it's a very complex region, and you need a deep pool of diplomatic actors with a lot of experience and a lot of networks and some personal, skin in the game. And that's just not China. China's top tier of diplomatic actors are Japan experts, they're America experts, they're Russia experts. They're not Saudi experts. If you're the top Saudi guy in China's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, you might be the special envoy to the Middle East, but you're not going to be the Minister of Foreign Affairs. So, China's diplomatic capacity has always been quite modest. China's economic capacity is quite big, and you'll see, like, their state-owned enterprises have a deep footprint. Their commercial actors are considered quite connected, but diplomatically, it's still kind of at that kind of third rung. There's the U.S. at the top, despite everything. Despite all of the popular frustration with America's position, it's still at the top. And then you've got the British and the French and all these European countries that have deep, long experiences here, in Turkey and Russia. And then you've got kind of China and Japan and India, these kind of newcomers. So it doesn't really affect China's diplomatic standing because it was always more of a Western construct that China was a major actor here. The Saudi-Iran rapprochement, that was baked by the Omanis and the Iraqis in the year leading up to the announcement. That was a homegrown initiative. The Saudis were working with the Omanis and the Iraqis to make this, bring it together. And when Xi went to Riyadh in December 22, he was presented this kind of nearly fully baked gift. Look, we've been working on this. We need kind of a great power sponsor. We need a country that has a good relationship with us and a good relationship with Iran. And there's only two. Really, I mean, maybe India, but India is not that diplomatically ambitious in this part of the world. It was Russia, it was China. Of course, Russia was preoccupied with Ukraine. It couldn't be the US because it has no diplomatic ties to Iran. So, China, how would you like a gift? How would you like this wonderfully designed thing? All you have to do is really get the Iranians on board. And I mentioned President Raisi, who's since passed away. He visited China 2 months later. That was the point, right? Let's bring him here so we can get this proposal in front of him and see if there's interest in it. But it wasn't something that China had put together. China got a lot of credit for it. I think the convening power was interesting, and they do deserve credit for that because not many countries could do it. But it wasn't really a Chinese designed initiative. And you can see Iranians have written about this. There's an Iranian PhD student at, I think, Australian National University. She wrote a really good article about this. Some Chinese academics have also written it. So it's not my kind of skeptical or cynicism. This is, people who are on the inside who have seen, that this was really mostly initiatives designed by local actors to solve a local problem.
Jonathan's article will be available in the show notes, so for listeners who are interested, you can always check it. So, Alisa, let me come back to you. Gulf sovereign wealth funds have been among the most active investors in China in recent years. Has the regional crisis given them pause, or does instability elsewhere actually make Chinese assets look more attractive at this stage?
This is a very interesting question, but an even more complicated story than what you just alluded to, because it's a bi-directional investment flow by now. So if you think about Saudi, Vision 2030, lots of money needed to achieve that vision. Where is Saudi heading for that? Basically, Hong Kong. I mean, through whether it's cross-border lending flows, whether it's potential IPOs in the future in the Hong Kong stock market. So there's that direction beyond, the direction you just referred to, where these massive sovereign wealth funds, which account to around 50% of global sovereign wealth fund assets, so it's really huge. Also, of course, went to China. I have to say they started very early. I wonder whether they made any money because I still remember this was Mubadala or, by Meituan. But this was before the whole, meltdown of China's private sector digital platforms and so on. I mean, they're doing a little bit better now. So, if they stayed, they probably recouped a little of that. But my point is that a lot of these ventures by sovereign wealth funds in China, same as GIC, same as Singapore, came when China was expected to balloon and it didn't. And yeah, now we have a recovery since mid-2025, but it's not massive. So, I'm trying to say two things here, that while we focus on how much the Middle East invests in China, wow, I mean, let's also focus on how much the Middle East is getting out of China or maybe Hong Kong. And I would say on their investments, because of what I just said, maybe it's mixed. Yeah, it's a mixed story, which again absolutely points to Jonathan's idea of peaking, because it was not El Dorado as it was thought to be. Yeah, I mean, these investments didn't work out all the time, actually barely. And now the Middle East needs the money. Yeah, it's like the Gulf needs the money. It needs to basically reconstruct a lot of stuff that has been destroyed, or simply put more money. Even if anything, I read about recently about Saudi's plans. If anything, just even fast forward this diversification. I heard about NEOM's port potentially becoming like a new route for oil exports. So they need the money, in other words, So now, even so, it's nothing personal, if you want, about China. But we didn't make much money. Second, we need the money, yeah. And if anything, we would like to borrow more, if anything, yeah. I'm just saying that we have maybe an impression that might not necessarily be the right one. I think the Gulf is going to need funding for quite some time. And now the question is, and this is a very important question, will Chinese banks continue to lend? Will they take this opportunity, or will they fear? Yeah, will they retrench? Or because Iran's story is very telling. When things are not clear, maybe I'm not jumping in. Yeah, I have this big plan, but I'm not really executing it. So we need to watch, because maybe ironically, the economic relations between the Gulf and China may be less rather than more after this crisis. And it all depends on how it ends. Yeah, it's like okay, of course the US has lost a lot of credibility, but has China really jumped in to solve the problem? And again, maybe even if it's not a judgment, the mere fact that they need the money to reconstruct the region is in itself a very convincing argument to realize that there will be a little bit less, maybe, flows on both sides than we thought there would be. That's for me a key question mark. I'm not sure what's going to happen, but I wonder really whether this idea that is ever growing relations, they're never going to stop. I mean, I wonder whether this crisis will change that a little bit.
Yeah, all this just sounds, very transactional. Like Jonathan mentioned. So, Jonathan, let me come back to you. So, the Gulf states have long managed quite careful balance. So, it has US security guarantees on one side and then also deep economic ties with China on the other. Has this crisis shifted that balance in any lasting way?
No, I don't think so. That narrative gets used, that shorthand of U.S. security, China economic stuff, and to Alicia's point, even before this war, GCC countries were deeply, in this process of diversification. These national development agendas, the Gulf or the Saudi Vision 2030, the Abu Dhabi Vision 2030, New Kuwait 2035. These are all development agendas meant to create sustainable economies. This rentier model of over-reliance on hydrocarbons. Everybody realizes this is a problem, a structural problem, and they've been trying for decades to try to reverse it. So these vision agendas were, how can you build sustainable economies that are built on more than just energy? How can we create new jobs, new industries? And China's cooperation in that was pretty important. But one of the things that I don't think it's really recognized enough beyond the region is, China's the number one trading partner of pretty much every country in the Arab world. That's a fact. If you're measuring trade in goods, China's very important. What these countries want is trade in services. They want to create these new industries, and they need education and training and financial services. And it doesn't show up as dramatically on the balance sheet, but I would argue it's probably more important, long term. And that's where you see a lot of European businesses and American financial institutions and educational institutions playing a very important role. So I always push back at this idea, like China's the major economic partner and the US is the security one, because you can see, just like, for example, in the AI sector here in the UAE, where they've made a decision that the US is the more important partner in their AI ambitions. I also think when countries here look at China as an economic partner, you said transactional again, and I agree, there's kind of a buyer-seller dynamic. It's not a partner dynamic. It's more of like a customer-seller dynamic. And what you'll find is, yes, China buys a tremendous volume of energy products from the GCC countries. That's all they buy. There's very little else in the basket of trade that goes from the Gulf countries to China. Meanwhile, you'll find everything from A to Z, that China sells here. And it creates the vulnerability, because China's made it clear 2030 is the year of peak hydrocarbon imports, 2060 is net zero. China's telling everybody that it wants to be using less, or I guess fewer, hydrocarbons in the near term. And these countries are thinking, well, that's all they buy from us. If our number one trading partner is going to stop buying the one thing they want, then that's a structural vulnerability. So they've been trying to move away from this. So I think that's kind of just to put a little context in this idea of China handles the economic stuff while the US handles the security stuff. What we've seen from this, I mean, I live in Abu Dhabi. When the war started, it was reckless. I thought it was stupid. I couldn't understand why Donald Trump would do such a thing. We knew it was coming, but it just seemed so strategically bereft of any logic that, why is this happening? But that Iran's first impulse was to start attacking Gulf countries' civilian infrastructure, I think made a lot of foreign policy decision makers on this side of the Gulf, it made them realize that they were right to double down on the US security relationship, to have these defense cooperation agreements, because nobody else has the volume of material that can be used to knock down these Iranian drones and missiles. No other country is willing to make the kind of commitments that the US has made. And for a lot of, European listeners, and I'm from Canada, a lot of folks in Canada would look at American foreign policy towards its allies and partners and feel not too good about it. But I think in the Middle East, it's kind of been a different approach, where folks here think, well, that security arrangement with America has been quite satisfactory. And in terms of what China's had to offer, well, it's been very mushy. China's not offering anything really. Kind of thoughts and prayers, saying, we hope both sides will find a way to solve this. And it's not actually taking a leading role in this. So I think countries realize Beijing isn't willing to be a very substantial security partner. I don't think that's a criticism. I just think it's just a statement of fact. China's interests are elsewhere. It's not willing to devote those kind of resources, diplomatic or military, to this part of the world. So I think China will continue to be primarily an economic actor. America will continue to be a security actor, but I also think it's important to recognize that America does a lot more than just the security stuff.
Thank you very much for that. In the end of our podcast, since we're sitting from Europe, so I also want to bring our eyes back to Europe. So, Alicia, where is Europe's position in this?
I want to add something to what Jonathan said, and then I go very briefly. I was thinking about this peaking beyond all of the reasons that weighs our deal, if you think about what Jonathan said on Iran. In the case of Saudi, UAE, there was this diversification story, I don't know, buying green tech, and there was like a complementarity that was very obvious. The Gulf was selling oil and gas, and China was basically feeding the Gulf with the future, meaning the future energy, once the fossil fuels would be kind of disappear from the face of the world. Well, first, as we know now, that's going to take longer than we thought, number one. But number two, the AI revolution is there. And what does that mean? What it means is that if you look at UAE's imports, this is true even for China. It's all about GPUs from the US. It's like there's been a switch which is unrelated to politics. No, it's related to what really matters now. And what really matters now is to be basically to develop, the UAE is actually probably beyond the US and China. You're going back to your point on Europe. The UAE, this small country, is developing its own kind of sovereign AI, its own stack, as we say, faster than Europe. But for that, they need the US. So there's this irony that, China was central for something that was very important, yeah? Climate change, everybody was talking about that, demonstrating that, you are in that game. No, now it's a different game. But that game is run by the US. So, what Jonathan was saying about this peaking, I think there's this additional factor that is not only the UAE or the Gulf, it's actually quite global. It's even true for Europe, going back to your point. I think for Europe, this is coming. Yeah. I mean, as much as we are dependent on China for so many things, but the US is now at the core of that massive revolution, which we will have to jump in at some point. But when it comes to relations to your question between Europe and the Gulf, I can only tell you that I think we've missed a huge opportunity with our confusing AI positions. I would start with Gaza. I mean, this was really, as everybody knows in Europe, we shot ourselves in the feet by not being clear visioned on this. I think now the Europe's response to Trump, somehow, even if not so coordinated, because the UK is on the same front, I think it's more authentic. And I think that that could serve the purpose of a future improved relation with the Gulf, because Europe could have followed Trump. I mean, it could have just said, you know what? I mean, but it hasn't. Not to the full extent, by all means. And I think that is a signal that Europe is not only an appendix of the US when it comes to foreign policy, but when it comes to this part of the world. So for me, and kind of a renewed, more authentic relation between the Gulf and Europe could be possible in the aftermath of this conflict.
Thank you very much for this interesting conversation. As we mentioned, this is an incredibly complicated region, and we're so happy to have with us today Alicia Garcia Herrero from Google and Jonathan Fulton from the Atlantic Council to join us to decipher a little bit of all this mystery. You can find all our research on China at Google.org and sign up for Zhonghua Mundus, our monthly China podcast and newsletter, with link in the show notes. Until next time, bye bye.